And this is now talking with Professor Ed Lilly at Harvard Observatory on 14 August 1979. Well, to start off, can you tell me what your educational background was and how you first came in contact with astronomy and then with radio astronomy?
Well, I had a... Stand by. I had a B.S. and an M.S. in physics from the University of Alabama, and the destiny would have been Chicago in physics, but Donald Menzel arrived on the scene to dedicate a new physics building for the Alabama Physics Department, and I became interested in, from his talk on that occasion, became interested in radio astronomy, which he outlined, and ultimately visited him here in Cambridge. He became interested in a little effort we had undertaken in Tuscaloosa when the mayor of Birmingham wanted to seal the cornerstone of the new city hall with light that left a star at the time Birmingham was founded.
This is beautiful.
This request went from the mayor of Birmingham to the president of the University of Alabama, to the chairman of the physics department, to the electronics professor, Ferd Mitchell, who was a graduate student. It was me, and I got the task of doing this. And we had a 15-inch Fecker telescope as part of this new building, which Menzel came down to dedicate. And we arranged the photo cell, and once we got a relay to close, we were home free. But to give it local color, we soaked a cotton ball in ether and put it in the gap of a Tesla coil. And that
this is great.
That produced...
So you found the right star that was 100 light years away? Or
yeah, Arcturus was about 80 light years away, which is what we wanted, but it was fast disappearing in the west.
And it gave you a nice signal of noise also.
Oh, yeah. So we had to keep the light going for the dedication ceremony, which came a month or two later and a lantern, which another graduate student had the assignment of keeping full of water. Oh, that's the way I...
This fellow Mitchell that you mentioned, is he the one that did some millimeter work later on?
F.H. Mitchell.
I've never talked to him. Is he still alive?
Yes, he's at the University of South Alabama.
Of South Alabama, I see.
Yeah. He used to be at Alabama. He taught at West Point. I think he's written a couple of textbooks in physics. Yeah, he's a very interesting fellow.
And what about, there was a colleague named Whitehurst?
Yeah.
Is he still...
He spent some time at NRAO.
Oh, is he the fellow that's worked with Mort Roberts on a couple of papers, eh? Maybe that is?
Well, my knowledge of him at NRAO is like 15 years ago.
But there is a guy from Alabama that's been working with Mort named Whitehurst. I can't remember the initials.
Well, the age of the Whitehurst I have in mind would be 60.
Yeah, I've never met him, so
I don't know.
Okay, I haven't gotten to them yet. So anyway, so you came to Harvard then in astronomy rather than Chicago in physics.
Yeah, and in the same class with Dave Heeshan and some others that from that era. And on arrival here, the hydrogen line had just been discovered by Ewan and Purcell. And the talks and colloquia attendant to that were of great interest to us. And so the enthusiasm for that particular program was a natural.
Mm-hmm. Now, so it was more or less your own initiative to get involved in this. It wasn't Bach coming around stirring up interest?
No, we went to the, as best I recall, there was a colloquium one evening given by Purcell. One evening at Jefferson, I guess, in the physics department. I got very much interested in that. And I forget, the details are vague, but ultimately both Heeshan and I wound up working with Doc and with Purcell with the horn and the other equipment that had been assembled on the second or third floor of Lyman Hall.
More or less learning the ropes and how to use it?
Oh, sure, yeah. I think our intent was to take the equipment to Agassiz Station ultimately and put the horn on an equatorial mount and attempt to survey the galaxy. And of course the incident which stands out vividly is that for one reason or another the equipment vanished over one weekend, and the problem locally became how could this field of research be pursued.
So you knew nothing about this and all of a sudden it was gone.
No, we weren't privy to the political decisions.
So, I suppose also you were probably not involved too much in the matter of how could we pursue it here. That was more a matter of getting funds and so forth. That would.
Well, we were aware that there were possibilities. We kept hearing about the anonymous lady at Harvard, who, of course, was Mrs. Agassiz. We knew that was a possibility. We were aware of the early formation of the National Science Foundation. So I'm reasonably certain that our intent when we came to see Shapley was to promote some enterprise to generate money to restore the loss we had suffered.
And you say when we came to see Shapley, who was that?
That was Dave Heesch and myself.
And what was your request to him?
Well, our request, we notified him of the what we regarded as a significant loss and asked him to do something about it, and he did.
And were you asking for a specific dish, or did you want a horn to replace the one?
Well, I don't recall the specifics in the memorandum, but although it's, I think it's around somewhere in the file.
Well, presumably it's in his archives.
Well, there may be a copy here in this office, too. The net result is that he raised money from Mrs. Agassiz, which was used as matching funds, with a proposal which Dave and I participated in the writing. I believe Bach would have been the principal investigator.
Right.
Conceivably, Ewan was a co-investigator. I don't recall. But the proposal number I do recall, and it was in the 200s.
Hmm. Yeah.
It was something like it was one of the very early proposals
that
went to NSF.
And this proposal was successful.
It led to the 24-foot antenna at Agassiz, equatorially mounted, a hydraulics rack and pinion servo-driven gear on the polar axis, a real clue chipper system.
And was that bought off the shelf from some company, or was that surplus?
No, the engineer assigned to that from the D.S. Kennedy Company was Robert Grinsback. And in a way, between his knowledge of what Kennedy could do and our description of what we needed, he formulated the design in his study in Winchester. We went to see him at night and outlined what we needed, and the design evolved in his study and was made by the D.S. Kennedy.
So that was the first of many Kennedy radio telescopes.
Yeah.
Well, how long did it take to get this thing operating, and what about the receiver also? What were you going to do for that?
Well, my guess is that it was late 51 or maybe early 52 when the Enterprise got underway, and it must have taken a year and a half or maybe longer to bring the equipment to Agassiz and assemble it there. In parallel with that, Ewan had formed the Ewan Knight Company, and I think he also formed the Ewan Day Company.
Right, you told me about all these.
You go day and night, those early tales. And the equipment was, the electronic equipment was built over the Honeybee Cafe in Central Square, where Ewan had his early company floor space. Best of my recollection, Heeshan and I, along with Jack Campbell and other names that I don't recall at the moment, went down there in the evenings and worked as technicians and as solder jockeys assembling the electronics. And ultimately, after the integration of the system at Agassiz, then Dave and I, after the early shakedown phase, operated it 24 hours a day. 12 hours each, on and off.
Jeez, grueling.
7 days a week for quite a while.
Now, how was it decided what you were going to work on? Where did the ideas come from as to what to do with this?
Well, the ideas came from discussions with Bach, with a lot of influence from Bach. Dave and I, as I recall, developed our own ideas, which certainly were part of it. But I believe if we were privy to go back and oversee those discussions in those days, if they had been recorded on videotape. I suspect that Bach was clearly the dominant influence. In fact, the assigning of the regions of the sky to Haitian and to myself, Bach apparently gave considerable thought to, because it was done on the selected area basis, and selected areas were handed out to me in the anti-center and to Haitian in the center. And conceivably, Bach already knew there would be a long string of graduate students, and he could probably divide up.
Do a Carpenter seal in 21 centimeters.
Four pi star radians for a long time if you divided it up finely enough.
So the idea was to just to do a survey in a more or less random location in the galactic plane, and find out what was going on in a small area was.
That's my recollection that one would examine the spectrum of hydrogen from that region, or the spectrum from that region, and then determine as much as one could about galactic structure in that particular direction. Bear in mind, we're aware that the Dutch were surveying the galactic plane at the same
right.
time.
So you were not trying to do a grand survey like that.
In fact, Walter Botta came by during this period and in effect told Haitian we were wasting our time, because the Dutch had all of the observations that would be of use in this one-shot field. And they were now in the process of reduction, so we were in effect wasting our time.
Amazing. Now, your thesis came out in 1954, and in the introduction to it anyway, the whole thrust is that you were going to study a dust cloud and find out what was going on there, but it seems like this may have been a little bit later on that you reasoned, well, okay, what's going on in the anti-center and what can I make of this astrophysically? So you changed it from a random location to a more physical sort of thing. Is that correct? Or?
Well, I think in the anti-center, as I recall, the gas fell off quite rapidly north of the plane. And south of the plane in the Taurus dust complex, it held up with latitude rather strongly, and it seemed fairly clear that the outstanding difference between the north and south portions of the plane was the huge dust complex south of the plane. So in order to test that,
I see.
We then went parallel to the plane at 15 degrees, through several other heavy regions of dust, including Perseus and Orion, and in each instance a large amount of dust seemed to correlate very well with enhanced or sustained emission from the hydrogen.
Can you give me some idea of what it was like to observe at Agassiz at that time? What was the standard procedure?
I think I was living in a misnomer called the Summer Palace, which was a 1930s plywood prefab. Haitian was living in the Agassiz Cottage, which with slightly higher class accommodation. We worked 12 hours a day each, past each other, as it were, on the change of shift. And it was mostly setting the local oscillator, well, arriving for a shift for 12 hours, thermos bottle and sandwiches, with a log of the positions to be observed, setting the local oscillator, where you needed it for the particular region of the sky, setting up the coordinates, which meant in right ascension operating this hydraulic system, which tended to leak and clunk, and carrying on like that for 12 hours, and then stumbling back to produce data and go to bed.
Now, this was a single channel system, was it not? Were you tuning the LO to get the whole thing?
The LO scan and a signal channel and a comparison channel. The comparison channel being separated far enough so that it was not moved through the emission. And the difference of those two channels was the quantity displayed.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you had all the reduction to do on the strip chart recordings.
Oh, sure.
So what would you say was the main result from your thesis?
Regions of interest were characterized by lots of dust, and I think switching to looking at it from the zone of avoidance enabled a calculation of the total quantity of dust, and there seemed to be a very good correlation between the total extinction in the direction and the number of hydrogen atoms, with an average quantity of about 100 to 1 for the mass density ratio of hydrogen to dust.
So there was a lot of gas in these clouds, which was not uniformly known at that time or accepted.
Yeah.
Were you thinking at all about possibly molecular hydrogen? What component that might be, or is it?
I suppose it was discussed. I don't recall specifically. I don't think it was included in any of the papers written.
I didn't see it in the thesis at all.
I think molecular hydrogen may have been discussed, but it certainly wasn't written down. And there was no apparent way of finding it.
Okay, so having gotten your degree, then what was the next step?
NRL. In fact, Fred Whipple suggested NRL because of the presence of the 50-foot antenna coming online, and thought that would be a good place to be, and as it turned out, it was.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you find in the way of a group, and what was going on when you got down there?
Well, the principal characters that I recall in the group were John Hagen, Ed McLean, Fred Haddock, and Cornell Mayer.
Right.
Also Ben Yapley, and perhaps others I would recall.
Well, sure,
in sufficient
Sloniker.
But those were the those were the fellows. The main impression of the first days was that the apparent discovery of hydrogen absorption by Hagen and McLean, which was an intriguing concept. In fact,